Hello and welcome to the News Club podcast, where we talk about the news and more importantly, what to do about it. This season, we're speaking with the people, the rebel citizens who aren't just talking about the headlines, but actively working to rewrite what comes next. Today, we've got guest Hamza Yusuf, British Palestinian political researcher and writer based in London. And I think, well, Tom, the term you used last week was fearless and committed activist and journalist. And I think nothing could be truer. But yeah, I'll pass on to you, Hamza. Who are you?
I think all the above fits. I've dabbled into a bit of journalism of late, which wasn't my initial trajectory, so if that qualifies as a journalist. But yeah, I've done a lot of journalism of late, investigative reporting, writing, commentary, opinion. And ultimately, the way I see it is there is a failure of the media, and so there are gaps to plug. And so that's what I see effectively what I'm doing. So irrespective of whether that's can be considered research, journalism, writing, whichever title is used, it's basically filling in the gaps where the mainstream are leaving behind and failing ultimately. So that's rather than a job title, I see it more as a, shall we say, a mission.
Yeah, Hamza, I think we've been really excited to talk to you because a lot of the people we talk to on this show are sort of like you. They're independent newsmakers, they're independent journalists, they've set up their own outlets, they've established sort of cooperatives or groups or networks of people who want to do the news better, do media better than what we're seeing. But I think where you stand out is that you're very much like going out into the wild of the mainstream media that so many of us see as failed, and particularly on the question of Gaza and Palestine, not only failed, but complicit in what's happening. So to talk to somebody who not only writes about and exposes so much of what's going on in a way that the mainstream media doesn't, you then take that to the mainstream media and confront them with their failures and directly challenge the commentators and the journalists and the pundits who, it seems like, whether they are doing it explicitly or not, are trying their best to erase Palestinian issues, to erase Palestinian voices, to equivocate on what's happening in Palestine. So I just wanted really to know, I mean, it'd be great to have a really long conversation about this, but you might have like a one-word answer to how you do it. But what is your sort of mindset going into these, you know, these LBC presentations, Sky News interviews and so on? What do you hope to get out of them? What do you go into them doing? And how do you do it? How do you bear going in the face of these people who have spent so much of their time delegitimizing the existence of Palestinians and excusing what's going on in Gaza?
So one thing which I think is maybe understated, and you'll know this as well, Tom, is a lot of these presenters and a lot of kind of the mainstream media, they kind of live in a bubble. So going into an interview, I go into it on the basis that I know what I might say or what I might touch on is probably where most of the public stand as well. But I'm also going into it on the basis that the people who are interviewing me also think they're right. Two people can't both be right. And I'd like to think, especially when it comes to Gaza, in terms of where public opinion is, I'd like to think when you're raising certain points, it's the public that would agree with the side that I'm, if we want to call it sides, the side that I'm taking. And so I remember somebody told me very early on, they said, I don't know whether this is good advice, but they just said, go in and say whatever you're going to say regardless. Mm. Whichever question is thrown at you, you need to have a specific perspective and a specific kind of angle that you want to hammer home, because it's not going to be courteous. It's not going to be in good faith. It's not going to be like they would treat other guests, for example. And that's the same on most topics. It could be on welfare. It could be on anything socioeconomic. Just generally, anything that the mainstream kind of disagree with, it's a whole different line of questioning. It's a whole different process. And so my very first one, I did Sky News quite early on, and I remember being interrupted. And you know, I remember thinking, okay, well, I know I'm going to be interrupted anyway. But then the producers were like, oh, we want to get you back on, you know, because you were interrupted. We'll give you another chance, etc. And I went on there and they just asked that question, like, oh, what is Israel to do? You know, this is self-defense, etc. Mm. And then there was a clip, I think, that went viral. And it's like you said, it's they're not having these conversations in good faith. And so any kind of rebuttal to that, I think the public would like to see. And so whether it's me, whether it's someone else, I just think there's an appetite now for kind of a critical perspective. And so whether it's LBC, whether it's Sky, whichever it is, it's interesting because a lot of Palestinians have been called on a few times and they're not being called back on, which I think suggests that's, you know, quote unquote, a good thing in the sense that they've delivered something, they've delivered a different perspective, a more critical perspective. And so the media have now tried to alter the trajectory of the conversation. But yeah, I mean, I just see it now more so as building an archive. I think we know that the media has chosen complicity, and not, you know, when we talk about complicity, it's not just being passive bystanders. They are active participants in this. The way that they whitewash, the way that they dilute, they distort and they deceive on behalf of Israel's campaign in Gaza. And so for everything that you can document, for every interview, every article, every report is what I'd like to think will be used when there is a reckoning. And that's the way I see it now. So if it's a piece critical of the media, if it's a kind of a summary, if it's an analysis, it's just basically look at some point, hopefully this contributes to holding to account those in the media.
Absolutely, absolutely. Like you say, it's a perspective that besides obviously just being critical and, as you say, right within the given context, right? It's also just, it's that which is shared, right? It's that which we care about. Like there's never been something so decisive among people, right? I've never seen so many like, you know, like Free Palestine graffiti that is written in any and every place possible. Like it is very much the consensus, and like the fact that it's so ridiculous that consensus is not reflected in our media. It's ridiculous, but it's also not surprising, right? And it's why we ask what I'm going to ask you now, which is what should be headline news and isn't, right? Because as you say, right, like we're all very, very aware, especially at News Club, right, the extent to which media moguls, etc., like in terms of the power structures that are determining what we get to hear about, why we get to hear about it, etc., right? So yeah, I guess we ask this question to hear not only in perhaps like a particular story that ought to be heard, but also just like themes that are outright just never discussed, niche things that we know would be interesting and valuable, but that like, yeah, don't get spoken about ever because the spotlight is always on a distracting conversation, never on that which actually matters.
Yeah, I think it's a good question because just broadly and not even just on specific topics, the kind of the general kind of, shall we say, umbrella of like injustice or kind of like atrocities or whatever it might be, that's generally underreported in the media. Like what makes news is not really news most times. It's, you know, I remember there was a clip recently. BBC News had a humanitarian chief of one of the groups outlining the depth of the kind of the suffering in Gaza. And they cut them off about halfway through and said, oh, Keir Starmer's making some speech about just another kind of word salad, some promise, you know, as politicians do, right? You know, one of these press conferences in some town somewhere to show that he's in touch with the people and all the rest of it. And it's just, that was like a textbook case of like distraction because somebody was just about to touch on something really important and newsworthy. And then they said, oh, hold on a minute. The Prime Minister is about to say this. And he didn't say anything important. He just said, this is just some new
project. He never does. You never need to worry about it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I think that, you know, I think with Mark Twain, who said not reading the newspaper makes you uninformed. Reading the newspaper makes you misinformed. And that's ultimately where we are with the news. You don't get a rounded picture. You don't get the dots painted for you. You're not able to piece together the reality. And so on the whole, there are I think a lot of people have made the point, is propaganda by omission. So what should be in the news, for example, if we're talking specifically about Gaza? Okay, fine, you get the daily roundups and all the rest of it, but kind of the complicity of the British state, like what is Britain doing, for example, with RAF bases? What is the level of intelligence? What support have they offered? Kind of all the kind of the background and the context. And that just goes back to it in terms of what actually makes news. Because if you were to paint this comprehensive picture, if you were to allow people to connect the dots properly, then they'd have a much more profound understanding about what's happening. And so it goes back to the heart of what we were saying. The news isn't by any stretch of the imagination. Firstly, it's not new, nor is it anything to do with updating, informing and educating people. And there's just so many aspects to touch on, you know, even just the context that they don't apply. I was looking at the reports and the different analysis following the recent summit with the European leaders and Trump, and some of the words describe Russia, you know, Russian invaders, and every inclusion of or mention of Putin would be followed up by who has an arrest warrant out for him, etc., etc. And it's just like an example of how the media should report and how the media can report. And again, it goes back to what makes the news and how the news is framed. It plays a huge part in people's conscience and people's understanding, and the media effectively insulates people from understanding. So what should be the news is basically, the short answer is everything that is currently in the news basically shouldn't be. So the opposite of what should, kind of a more rounded. So whatever you see on, for example, BBC News at 10, just think, okay, well, there's a lot more to this story. That's I think that's the best way to describe it.
Yeah, and there's other stories that we just never get to hear. Do you know what I mean? And whether that is on that global scale, national scale, or local scale, there's always, at the end of the day, that silencing is a very intentional desire to like sway public opinion in a given way, right? Like that's always what it's been, right? It's hard not to separate this from some form of state propaganda at the end of the day, right? Like, at the very least, I think that's like a big part of how I perceive it, right? And I think we can appreciate that these things are not always exclusively one thing or one side or one person's opinion, but you can always understand that at the end of the day, so long as it's guided by economic interest in the way that it's guided insofar as we, like, you know, it's profit seeking, that will forever and always determine the kind of stories that we get out. And it's why we, you know, we've had a really, really brilliant conversation with people from community media in Scotland and Government Hill, in other places. And I think remembering and seeing examples of independent media being able to actually, like, change that, or not just change that, but, like, offer a different perspective because of a different economic principle in which they're founded, right? One which is membership based. I think it allows us to see those alternatives. But at the end of the day, it's the mainstream that obviously has the attention of most people. And it's that attention economy that we're obviously trying to, like, shift in some way, shape or form and be able to come to not just understand, but actively engage with. And I think, yeah, your work does a fantastic job of that, right? I mentioned I've got a friend staying with me. I was like, you know Hamza Yusuf, right? And they're like, yeah, I've heard that name. And it's those kind of people that, like, you know, like, it's the kind of people that aren't always engaging with the news, but, you know, it's generally there, it's in their minds, it's in the periphery, it's in the zeitgeist. And I think that's important. That's really important. But anyways, on to a little bit more as to your work and what you do, generally speaking. What are your motivations behind why you do it?
So I've always been a bit of a cynic, to be perfectly honest with you. I've always been a bit critical. I've always, even before kind of the last 2 years, just in general, I've always had, never really trusted the media, always been kind of firmly anti-establishment. And you grow up kind of, you know, like with what you hear from, like, your parents and friends and all the rest, you just grow up with, like, an inherently cynical understanding or perception of the media and kind of the politicians, etc., etc. So I've never shied away from kind of criticizing. So it kind of makes sense. But yeah, I think when I started to get into a bit of writing, a bit of journalism, a bit of investigating, I realized that there are, so the way I see it is that, and I've spoken to Tom about this before, I'm not really that interested in obtaining a Guardian column, for example, right? I'm not that interested in climbing up the ladder as some broadcaster, state broadcaster or whatever. So I feel like I can go a bit further than perhaps others. And that's not to say that I'm doing something better than them. It's just I've written a lot, for example, about The Guardian, or documented a lot about The Guardian's coverage of the genocide. Whereas I think a lot of people might be like, oh, you just maybe never know, you may be offered that column, which most aspiring journalists of a left-wing shade, shall we say, would probably still have that firm trust in The Guardian. But I just, like I said, having been growing up firmly anti-establishment, firmly cynical and apprehensive about the media, it just makes everything that bit easier, in the sense there are a ton of stories, as we've discussed, the media doesn't cover everything accurately and comprehensively, so there's almost a market there for somebody to do so, and there are so many other great journalists that are already doing this. And I just, yeah, that whole recognizing that there's 1,000 things that are not covered and 1,000 stories that should be covered properly, that's effectively what drove it. I just realized there's a gap. And in terms of, from a personal point of view, in terms of being a British Palestinian, there wasn't much coverage on Palestine just in general, nor was there a kind of a quote unquote authentic kind of a voice that is, you know, a Palestinian voice, for example. And so I just kind of, all of those factors married together, and post October the 7th, I think they highlighted and sharpened the reality that, you know, we need more critical voices. We need to hold power to account. We need to move away from kind of these conventional ecosystems, whether it's media, whether it's politicians, etc. And so all of that basically created, like, fertile terrain to just investigate and report at will, which is a lot, like, most of my work now is Declassified UK. And it's a lot, it's, people always say, oh, it must be so hard. It's actually quite easy, because there's so much left by the mainstream media. So when you have to interview, for example, as the editor has done countless times, you know, door-stopping RAF chief or door-stopping a politician. If that was being done by ITV, by Sky, by BBC, there wouldn't be anything for Declassified to do, right? But because there's so much that's left unattended, there's so much that's left uninvestigated, there's so much that's left out there, it's just about us to kind of tap into that curiosity that I'm sure a lot of people do have. And so, like I said, when it comes to, I hadn't done much investigative pieces before, and then at Declassified I kind of realized that there is not just an appetite for it, but of how important it can be. And as I said, a big part of that now in this current climate is about kind of increasing the archives and adding to the archives. So that in the one that I always refer to, for example, is I did a piece in January 2024, I think it was, about the beheaded babies. And nothing, people say, oh, that's a great piece. It was just taking information that's readily available online, right? What did the Daily Express say? What did the Independent say? What did Sky News say about this? Who reported it, and how did they climb back? Did they apologize, etc.? And in years to come, when people need a source for how was the beheaded babies framed, this kind of this period of manufacturing consent. Hopefully there's an article that contributes to that. So it's just basically that. It's basically, you know, whether it's media complicity, whether it's, you know, aspects that people don't touch on. I just think it's become easier now to do that kind of journalism. Just because it's such a kind of a vacuum by the mainstream. And so I think it's now fashionable to be anti-establishment, anti-media.
Wait till it's not again.
I think that's been one of the like positive things of the last few years, has actually been demonstrating that there were always these very powerful, very mobilized independent news outlets, particularly around the Middle East and Palestine. The flip side of that is the way that they have got more recognition and more exposure is in the wake of a genocide and they're reporting on it. But it's demonstrated that those structures already existed. And there were journalists and independent media workers who were very passionate about reporting it, as you say, in a way that these were all great big gaps that were being left by the mainstream media. These were things that they exist to report on, and by accident or by design, were just ignoring them. And it didn't take too much sort of major innovation in the way that news was done for independent outlets or journalists like yourselves to do that same work in a way that was accurate, accountable, telling the truth about what was going on in Gaza. So I think it's been great to see that where we talk about a lot on this podcast is about how do we build new structures of journalism and independent media, that actually in that case, you already had the structures that were there and the networks and the organizations and the collaborations with the Palestinian community. But then coming back to like where you were saying about the practices of the journalism you're doing and like how you're up against this bubble of mainstream media, because I suppose as well as like educating so many more people and informing them about what's going on in a way that they, as you say, they are receptive to it because they can see that this is a great injustice that's going on, and actually having news and updates and revelations about the extent of what's going on is what they're looking for. But then getting through that barrier of the outlets that the decision makers and the politicians pay attention to, and when the kind of news logics of those platforms is, as you say, just about what has Keir Starmer said about Gaza, or what is Benjamin Netanyahu saying about Gaza? Not about what is happening in Gaza, but what are these elite politicians and what are these media commentators saying? So I guess what's your... And this, I guess this is my way of getting around to this, like, how do you get through that question of, do you condemn Hamas? How do you get around these questions of, what should Israel do instead? Right, there are always these attempted gotchas by the mainstream media where anytime they're interviewing a Palestinian or a Middle East reporter or someone who shows any kind of basic sympathy or humanity towards Gaza, it is not about what's your perspective on this, it's how does your perspective fit into our questions, right? So what's your, I mean, you've got some really great viral clips of just like completely diffusing those situations and exposing how ridiculous the question is, but like, what, again, what's your aim in going into those situations where you know you're going to be asked those questions? What's your sort of like way of, and like to call it getting around it is ridiculous because that's falling into their trap of thinking that it's like something that needs to be addressed. But like, what's your approach for dealing with the scummy situations that editors and producers put you into when they invite you onto these shows?
So I think at the beginning, I was actually a bit apprehensive at the beginning. So I remember going into the Sky News one and being like, oh, what if they ask me? Like, I hope I answer it properly. Because you've got almost, you know, if you kind of capitulate and if you kind of, because everything's live and it's like, it's a media. So if you fall into the trap and don't answer adequately, there's their moment. Ah, he failed to condemn, ah, typical, et cetera, et cetera. And to be honest, luckily they didn't ask me because I wasn't sure how I would answer it. But then I did an interview recently on LBC with Ben Kentish, and it was following the Bob Villain, the ridiculous coverage of the Bob Villain saga, shall we say. And he then asked me, do I condemn what Bob Villain said? And I just basically said, I just pushed back. I said, I'm not going to fall into this trap of condemning. And I said, so rather than simply not condemn, I also said, this is a trap. So like, so people could at least hear that and be like, I just decided to be defiant and just push back. And it wasn't a plan. It just, as the conversation started, and he then decided to, I raised some points and I basically said, you know, Israeli officials have said much worse and it hasn't been documented. So if we're actually going to be outraged by something, let's be outraged by what Israeli officials said and then followed up with. And it just kind of went around in circles. And then he then said, oh, well, don't you find it offensive, et cetera, et cetera. Do you condemn it? And he just kept asking, do you condemn it? Do you condemn? Do you condemn? And I just refused to answer. And I said to him, I'm not going to fall into this trap. And he said, oh, it's not a trap. I'm just asking your opinion. And I said, no, it's a trap. And I refused to answer, et cetera. And somebody then pointed out to me afterwards that when LBC uploaded the full clip, there was actually a lot of comments. People like, oh, fair enough. Like, I'm glad to see people pushing back against this. So I think the best way to approach it is to actually maybe showcase just how bad faith these conversations are, like when you're asking someone to condemn. And actually, to I didn't plan to use the word trap, but I just said to him, I'm not falling into this trap where you bring a Palestinian on and you ask them to condemn. And actually, there's a great report by the Centre for Media Monitoring about the BBC, which was revealed recently. And I think, I can't remember the exact figure, but no Israeli guests were asked to condemn, but I think at least 40 Palestinian were asked to condemn at the BBC. And that just goes to show, like, when you get an interview and they want your opinion, you've got to jump through hoops. You've got to kind of qualify to have your opinion first, and then they'll ask you. So they've called you on, and then it's like, okay, now prove your credentials, prove you're worthy of being here before you can have your opinion validated and legitimized. Whereas with the Israeli guests, I mean, we see it time and time again, whether it's the current spokesperson, whether it's the former spokesperson, Alon Levy, they just say what they want. Nobody questions them. Nobody challenges it. It's just repeated without caveat. And then a Palestinian comes on and they're like, oh, well, do you condemn? Well, you know what? I remember a ludicrous interview Channel 4 did with Ben Jamal, the head of the PSC, where they asked, you know, this was 1 month into Israel's genocide. I think 10,000 Palestinians had been killed by that point. And they said, you're marching in the streets, chanting from the river to the sea. Why are you hellbent on the destruction of Israel? As Israel was destroying Gaza, that's what Channel 4 decided to ask. It's that framing, isn't it? It's that whole thing of how they shift the conversation away. So like I said, the best way to address it is that when you go into these interviews, they're going to come quite aggressive. I just think be aggressive back. Because as I said, I think when the interview is concluded and it gets aired and people are streaming it, people are watching it, I think they'll realize, okay, This is a pathetic line of questioning. And I think it works in that sense. It's just basically push back, like, why are you asking me to condemn it? You've asked me for my opinion. My opinion is irrelevant in terms of what my view is. I can give an analysis. I can give a commentary on it. I can talk about the wider context. But whether I personally condemn, because it doesn't get applied for any other subject, right? You don't get called on about, for example, I don't know, the budget, and said, oh, do you personally agree with what Rachel Reeves is? You don't get asked that. You just get, what is your opinion on the facts and what's been outlined? But suddenly you have to personally condemn and personally offer your opinion and jump through these multiple hoops. Yeah, I just think the best way to do it is to, and the Palestinian ambassador does this quite well, where he says, I'm not going to, why are you asking me to condemn? And he just goes and reframes the question. And I think that's, when you play their game back at them, I think it works. Because they think they have the moral high ground and the control of the situation. And I just think challenging them back and saying, okay, well, if you want to get into a fight, let's...
Yeah.
I'll stoop down to your level then, if that's the level that you want to go for. So, yeah. But it's very easy to be caught off guard, I would say. In these interviews, they can just throw a curveball question at you, and especially if it's alive, it can change instantly.
But would you say that you do it because there's that gap and you're basically filling it? Would you say that there's a need for it and you're like, fuck it, I'll do it? Like, in terms of your role within that, like, when you're selecting which interviews you're going to be on, like, what is behind that decision making?
Yeah, like I said, I always see the next interview as the potential last one. So since if I've gone on LBC, if that's going to be the last one I do on LBC, let's make it a good one. Let's make it like a memorable one. Let's make, again, something that can be documented, that can be
for the archive. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So, because you just never know when they're going to pull the plug and when. To be honest, I've been called on to the BBC 4 times, and 4 times a senior producer, I think, has pulled the plug. But they've basically said to me, you know, oh, can you come on at this time? Kind of a producer or researcher has reached out. And about an hour later, or even just shortly before I'm meant to be on air, they'll say, oh, sorry, you know, can't have you on anymore. Now, I don't know what the reason is, but it is common practice for the BBC's senior producers to pull the plug on certain guests. So I'm aware that that can happen across the board. I just, whichever interview I go into, I'm just like, well, do you know what? It might be my last one. You might not invite me on again. But let's at least make this one where your line of questioning is, your ludicrous line of questioning is kind of exposed. And as I said, it's not because I think I have some unique talent. I've just been afforded the opportunity to appear on air. There's much better people, much better operators. They've obviously been boycotted. They've obviously been silenced and kind of invisibilized for as long as, until I reach that stage, I guess, for as long as I've been offered the opportunity, I'll just use it as I can. Because as I said, I'm not interested in later appearing on LBC or later appearing on whichever one it might be. If they ban me, if they boycott me, if they say, do you know what, red line next to your name, so be it.
And who else should we be looking to? Who are they boycotting that you still engage with, that you're like, this person knows what they're talking about?
To be honest, there are a few who I think are good, like across the spectrum, are good voices. But one which I think is notable and who has actually just spoken about this recently in terms of much less TV appearances is Owen Jones, right? So he still does the odd one. I think he does the, I forget the talk show on Channel 5. Is it Channel 5 or Channel 4 in the morning?
Yeah, it's the Jeremy Vine thing, isn't it?
Phoning in.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's it, yeah. Yeah, that's it, yeah. And he does that, but I've spoken, and I think he's said this in public, where he's had much less television appearances. And that specific show, they've got kind of questions that are vetted, and it's kind of, it's a more general, broad topics rather than specifically, we're going to talk about Gaza today. So he's had a few interviews post October 7th on Sky, BBC, etc. But he was on, as he said, I think recently in an interview, he was on television pretty much every other week before. He's obviously taken a very critical perspective now and challenged much of what's been pumped out and effectively been silenced. There are other journalists who have done well. Matt Kennard, the co-founder of Declassified, doesn't get, I don't think he's ever been invited on air at any, on any platform. Some of my colleagues at Declassified the same. So there are people who can, you know, offer sharp perspectives, who can give great commentary and precise and incisive thoughts to the media. But again, I don't think they're interested in that. And I think there is an element of, I've said this before, there is, we know the media is inherently cynical. There is maybe a box-ticking exercise here in the sense that if they bring me on, they can say we've brought on a Palestinian. So the question is, if I wasn't Palestinian, for example, if I was just another British citizen, for example, would I still have that same level of... And that comes with, like you mentioned, it comes with positives in the sense that's a platform, now use it. But there is definitely, I remember being asked quite early on by broadcasters, oh, we'd like to have a Palestinian voice on. And then when I'd finish, they'd be like, oh, you know, really want to get more Palestinians on. Now that you've been on, we'd like to have others on too. So there's kind of a process of like, oh, nobody can accuse us of not bringing Palestinians on. So do you recommend any others? And I'd give them names because I'd be like, I know this person's good. Let them come on, etc. But I definitely think there is that level of involvement too. I think that plays a part that, look, let's bring on a Palestinian and then nobody can accuse us of not platforming or silencing, or which that is inherently cynical as well, isn't it?
Yeah, there's like a big PR performative aspect of that.
When I see like Palestinian or British Palestinian sort of interviewed on the media, there is really a sense that like this is the opportunity for the host or the interviewer to like deflect the questions they should be asking themselves, where it's like, how is this atrocity going on? What is the British state's involvement in it? What is the international community's failed response, and why is it failing, and why isn't more being done? All of like the very specific questions which we have seen before our eyes over the last 2 years. Then it feels like, oh, we've invited a Palestinian on and they can answer that. And then we can do the like aggressive interviewing of the Palestinian guest. And it's their responsibility as Palestinians to answer the deep questions about why stuff isn't being done about it. And like, that's a completely flipped relationship, right? It's the role of the journalists to understand, why aren't these big changes happening? Why is this failure continuing? But as you say, it definitely, in many cases, it feels like there's a real box tick, particularly with Hamza Zolot, the ambassador, being brought on to say, now's your time to put across the case of why Palestine should exist. And then we'll go back to like just regurgitating whatever the British state or the Israeli state have said in response to what's happened today. It's, you know, a really, I'm laughing, but it's just such a like farcical and topsy-turvy situation, but it's so obvious for all to see. But then again, that makes it so great that when you go onto these platforms and you are able to get across the raw facts of what's happening and the clear analysis of why this matters and what needs to change alongside fulfilling that producer's box ticking exercise, it's like a double win, I guess, is they get what they want in their weird media logic, but you have an opportunity to put across the truth.
And yeah, at the end of the day, it's like a voice that, as we said at the very beginning, is like, it is the consensus. Like, this is what people think. This is what people have been saying. Like, if there's ever been like, yeah, like, I don't think I've ever seen friends and family care so much about any given topic, right? Like, it's so like overwhelmingly obvious and clear what like the stance is, because genocide is genocide. You know what I mean? Call it what it is. It's so simple. And that's, I think, partly why we find it so ridiculous when there's some such like strange puppetry happening behind the scenes of how they're able to like reframe things. And to kind of bring it back to a big theme that we like to explore here at News Club around what we do about it, right? Obviously, this is what you are doing about it, but do you have an observation about generally like what people should do? How should they not just be responding, but what should they be doing with their time? Because I think one thing is to speak about a matter, another thing is to do something about it. Obviously, a lot of people would want to take to the streets. Obviously, very recently, we saw however many hundreds get arrested for doing exactly that, for whether that was protesting or actively supporting Palestine action on a very simple, basic premise that what they are advocating for is basic, simple humanity. So obviously that is one thing that people are doing and is a really big aspect of how people are engaging with this politically. But would you say beyond that, like how else should people engage? What do you want to see people be doing?
I think it's one thing I always say is that there's no particularly right answer. So I think everyone has certain specialist tools in their toolbox, right? So everybody has a gift, if you like, that they can use. I think the main thing we need to be doing is building alternative ecosystems or at least structures. And I think we've proven of late, you know, the protests have been great. There's been other forms of activism, diligent organizing. The alternative media landscape, as we mentioned, has grown in such a short space of time. I mean, just to, anecdotally, trying to get something now pitched to Declassified, the bar is so high. And it's like I'm bringing up certain topics and they're like, yeah, but you know, someone else is doing this soon. And it's really good. Now that's, you know, I could turn around and say, well, that means less commissions for me. But it's really good for the because it's healthy competition. It means that you've got to raise your game. And it means that people are invested in reading and kind of contributing to this alternative space. And I think it's really important that we do build those alternative spaces. But also I would say that we maybe need to rethink our relationship with power a little bit, in the sense there are people in certain positions now, if you like, within mainstream organizations, and there, what tools that they have and what kind of skills they're equipped with are also helpful, because then they can also help us, right? Like people always ask questions, should I leave my job at Sky News, at BBC, etc. You've got great access, great resources, you've got all the best tech, you've got, so use that and then eventually use that against them, right? Benefit from it. And then eventually we can, you know, infiltrate from within, if you like. But I just think that the overall message, I think, is that we need to start building and sustaining alternative ecosystems. And I think we're on the way to doing that. But it's just that we have a habit, especially on the left, of infighting, of building up, you know, like a Jenga board. You start to build and then you pull one of the pieces out and bang, it's all collapsed overnight. So I would say it's not just within the media realm. There's within the activism spaces. People are now organizing protests, you know, random protests outside residences, outside the BBC, outside, etc., delivering certain messages, going to certain events, even small things, which I think play a huge part. I don't know if you saw, well, we must have seen the on BBC, the A-level results the other day, the clip where the guy said,
yeah, and the kid, and that kept on getting shared around. Yeah.
And then I got sent a message by someone who said, we're now kind of organizing. These are the primetime BBC shows. These are the primetime presenters. Whoever wants, and there's like a spreadsheet of people anonymously who have ticked, I don't mind calling it at this point, I don't mind calling it at that point. And they're basically saying, flood the BBC's phone lines, because these are talk shows, right? It's like LBC, you're meant to call in, right? And then, so even stuff like that, that's a good level of awareness. That's a good level of, I guess, thinking outside the box. And it's all about just ensuring that awareness, like you mentioned, there hasn't been a topic or an issue that has so collectively engrossed and appalled people and made them want to change things. And I think, like I said, if there's somebody that doesn't have the ability to write, to report, or doesn't work in a specific space, just picking up the phone, that can make a huge difference. You pick up the phone to one of these BBC Radio 4, which are one of these broadcasters, pretend you're interested in whatever topic they're talking about, and then slide in a little sentence. And eventually the BBC is going to reach a point where they're going to have so many of those, hopefully. And then it just keeps, the message keeps going out. And that's just one example of so many. It's just, I guess, like I said, it's just about keeping the flame alive, if you like.
Do you know which organising body is doing that?
I'll need to double check, and I can, and if you like, I can drop you a message afterwards and you can maybe mention.
Yeah, because we always like to share the kind of campaigns or the organisers that are kind of more actively involved in these kind of things, because, right, like a lot of, like you say, it's not just on the media front, but on organising, on activism. And yeah, I couldn't agree more with ecosystems. I think it's a constant thing that we talk about, right? It's like we need structures to be able to hold our work, to, like you say, make it sustainable, or else it will just be able to like topple down. And I think second to like leftist infighting is the calling out of leftist infighting in the left. I think it's the funniest thing, right? Like everyone always jokes about it, but at the end of the day, it's like I couldn't give a fuck. Like I really don't care what your niche opinion is on X, Y, and Z. Like I really don't care. I just want, you know what I mean, I just want us to be able to build. I want us to be able to sustain. I want us, like you say, like there is something really valuable about now having an independent media landscape that is able to have competition, even, right? Which is, like you say, indicative of quality, indicative of people's skills, of the fact that like this is now something that, you know, again, I think Declassified is a really good example of an independent media outlet that is doing exactly that, like holding space where it's needed and relying on our own structure, our own spaces, to be able to make that the case.
Yeah, no, I think just in general, it's good to see that there is a collective conscience and a collective will. It's just making sure that it's channeled in the right place. And like I said, sometimes people want to build on what's existing, but there's also nothing wrong with building alternatives and sharpening what we, there's sharpening what we have, and there's also building what we don't have. And like I said, within the activism space, there is a lot more, I guess, innovation now. There's a lot more kind of imaginative approaches being used. And that's good, because like I said, there isn't one right answer in how to deal with this. But as you mentioned, the one thing the right do really well is that, okay, we agree on the basic contours of this. Let's now just go press ahead. Whereas we're like, no, let's agree on everything before we move ahead. And you're never going to agree on everything. It's like we're waiting to call each other out. But yeah, like I said, the media has been built. The alternative media landscape is good. You've got people now, the independent movement within the MPs. And that looks like, you know, you've got a real opposition to the mainstream parties. You've got people who are not letting go in terms of protests, in terms of the organising. You've got different campaigns on the ground. Even just small things like, you know, printing certain or enlarging, like, you know, images and whatnot, and just plastering them outside the BBC, outside these HQs, etc. Standing outside X amount of buildings. It's just about sustaining the message. It's just about making sure that this is still alive in a lot of people's minds. And there are campaigns that I don't know about that I'm sure exist that are doing great work. Oh, yeah. And that's a good thing, right? That's because, you know, if I knew about every campaign, that would suggest that there's not that many, right? Whereas there are loads that, you know, you get sent messages and you get, you know, different actions. And a good thing is there, in all the different group chats and all the different things you get sent and you see, there are actions taking place all the time. It might be, you know, there was a protest outside, I think it was RAF High Wycombe, possibly, the other week. There's just always something going on, and it's because of there's different levers of complicity here, and it's just about making sure that we're hitting all the right points. So yeah, I'm quietly optimistic, but as I said, we have a tendency to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. So
it's just been so great to listen to you, Hamza, talk through like your motivations and like the strategies and the ideals behind what you do. And it's inspiring for us because, again, we speak to people who talk a lot about structure and building things. And then it's great to talk to someone who, as well as being involved in some of those structures, is like really out there, you know, practicing a better kind of journalism, like not just building the infrastructure that supports it, but then benefiting from that infrastructure and going out and doing it, particularly on an...
Right, and showing us
that, yeah, exactly, and then on an issue that is like more important than any other, and demonstrating that this is the value it can deliver. This is why it's so important. This isn't, you know, people go on about our local media is so important for like reporting about your local council or finding out how the bins get collected. And like, yeah, that's really important. But then there are these huge global generational issues that have to be addressed. And we sort of depend on the large media organizations to address them, and they're very clearly not. So it's almost like there's a brief moment for us to like celebrate that the infrastructure that so many different groups and campaigns have been building has borne fruit in powerful independent journalists like yourself and so many others, like in Declassified and 972 and New Internationalists and all these other groups that we've spoken to and hope to speak to. So yeah, it's just been really inspiring and great to hear your perspective on it.
Absolutely. And to kind of bring it to the last two questions, next month on the 20th of September at 2 p.m. we're going to be hosting an online news club. And news clubs are kind of our way of approaching organizing, basically. It's a book club, but for news, as we like to describe it. It's a means for people to kind of just begin having conversations, right? We ask those similar questions of like, what is in the news that interests you that you want to talk about, but what isn't in the news that you think should be, right? And that's kind of the starting point for then acting on it and to say, right, like, what can we do about it, right? I think oftentimes I think about my mum, right? Because she messages me and she's like, what happens if I like what happens? And I'm just there like, oh mother, you know, there are different ways that we can engage with it. But I think something that's really beautiful and valuable is understanding that actually you can engage and organize with people that are closest to you, that are your family, that are your friends, right? It doesn't just have to be campaigns that already exist, but like you say, campaigns that are unknown, because action really can be taken by anyone. And it can manifest in so many different and beautiful ways. But all of that to say, what would you bring to our News Club Live online news club?
As in me.
Well, yeah, like, I mean, you don't have to attend, but, you know, if you did.
You're very welcome to attend, but like, if you had a space where you were like, here's a different way we can talk about the news, what would be the thing you'd bring?
I'd bring a lot of cynicism, I think. but I do think, in firstly, those spaces are really important. And it has been kind of a lot of like behind the scenes conversations with other journalists, whether it's independent, local, or even those within the mainstream system, who have kind of like tried to open channels of solidarity and stuff, just because it's like everybody recognizes the moment we're in. So that's already good. So again, what you're doing is you're on the same wavelength as others, and I tell you that there's a common kind of theme here. And I would say, and it may sound cliche, but there is no right answer about what people can bring or their understanding and all the rest of it. Because, as I said, everyone has a kind of a unique perspective and a specialist skill or a way of seeing things. And so just, I think more important, and this isn't me dodging the question, I think more important is just having that space, if that makes sense. Like when you bring so many people together, rather than try to find out what are the best ways, I think the best things are often the kind of when you just let people operate with kind of like free will and like bring their perspectives and bring their understanding and exchange thoughts and kind of, you know, bounce ideas off. And that's when you realize it you know, it's thought provoking. It's like, oh, I hadn't thought of that. And just in general, as you mentioned, it's a great initiative. Why? Because there is complete lack of trust in the media. There's a complete lack of trust in the system. And a lot of people have it, but a lot of people maybe don't know where to channel that frustration or channel that to build and to look at alternatives and to realize that there are so many people like them who share those thoughts. Because often, even though as we talk about right and wrong, we might think, oh, we're on the right side. But there are a lot of people who are, but maybe don't realize the extent to which they're supported by others as well. And so the more that there are channels are opened for that, I think it can be really productive. So yeah, I'd bring that and cynicism.
Amazing. Thank you. All right. Okay.
I have an extra one as well, but we can save it for after.
Oh, go on. What would you bring it? I'd bring it.
Well, no, I had a very important and sensitive question for Hamza, but it may be one we don't want to include on the recording. Can I pitch it now?
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you
want
to ask it? Yeah, go on, pitch
Hamza,
it.
Hamza, how do you reflect on your time as First Minister of Scotland?
Do you know what? It's so mad. The thing is, there's at least, I think, three letters in different places in the names. And it's like, and I think we do look quite different in terms of if you just looked at the display picture of each one. And yeah, any tweet I put out there or anything, somebody will say, oh, you're tweeting about Palestine while Scotland goes to waste. And I'm like, mate, what's that got to do with me?
I mean, it was such an obviously silly thing for just like random anonymous people on Twitter to throw underneath in comments. But when like a member of the House of Lords did it as well, that's when I thought people just aren't reading what they put on the screen.
Yeah, and it's that whole thing of, these are the people that claim, you know, they're the ones that say we're in the wrong, right? We're the ones that we need to learn from them, etc. And they're the ones, you know, good faith and noble people. And you just think it's mad. The thing is, some things like you can kind of explain. I still can't wrap my head around. I can't explain it because it's as one of my friends said, it's like if there are so many names within the media which are quite similar, right? But they don't get mistaken for one another. But it's just like you get two people from a kind of a minority background and you just assume like only one is allowed to be in a certain position. So it's like it must be
you
that
have to
one.
Take turns using the name.
Which is, yeah, exactly.
Anyway, sorry that was stupid, but I just remembered it in the middle of our conversation.
No.
It had to be asked. It had to be known. It's valuable information. Now we know. Right, okay, but now, last question. What is the one thing everyone should do leading up to 2029? We asked this question because someone part of the team says that, you know, we may or probably will or are already living in a Europe and UK that is run by authoritarians. So in light of this, you know, if and when Farage is elected, what should we do? What should we be doing, you know, before that happens?
I think going to the theme of today is to begin reimagining how our relationships are with those structures that we've gotten so used to. So whether that's Westminster, whether it's Fleet Street, whether it's even just your local council, etc., and local kind of politics. It's just basically making sure that we're equipped in the best possible way. Because as you look now, just in general, I mean, I had LBC on earlier. They're talking about the St. George's flag. Should it be painted on a roundabout or should it not? Should it be up on the... Should it be hoisted as a flag?
Should be on every roundabout.
Yeah, exactly. And it's these conversations that might seem harmless. There are a lot of sinister conversations taking place, kind of a very weird framing taking place, like kind of stoking tensions, conversations about Palestine action, conversations about Palestine protests. So I just think we need to be equipped and ready for battle in the figurative sense, because there's a big battle of ideas, I think, coming as well. And one thing, I was in a conversation with someone recently, I think we at the very least are building towards, or if all three of us here would, for example, imagine or at least have a decent understanding of the type of world we want to live in, right? Whereas I think the right often are just angry, and so they just want to smash up and they want to rip up and this and that, whereas I think we need to make sure that we have a worldview or a perspective that we can build towards and do it properly. Because as I said, there's going to be a lot of conversations, as you mentioned, whether it's Farage, whether it's all these other people, about the type of country we want to live in, the type of global, where it sits in the global world, the type of what it supports, where it sits. So yeah, I just think we need to be equipped, and everybody should probably start sharpening their tools for that, in the sense that there will be a reckoning, there'll be a time to I guess, challenge and kind of interrogate where we're going. And I just think we can't afford to be complacent.
Absolutely. Kind of put it by myself. Thank you so much, Hamza, for your time. Really, really appreciate it. Thank you, Chivers, again for hopping on. Any last words before we fuck off? Sorry.
Not from me, no. We're not fucking off. We're leaving to go and build all the great structures that Hamza's been inspiring us to build.
We've been building it. We're here. But yeah, go check out Independent Media. If you need the list of Independent Media, IMA website, the Independent Media Association has a list of a bunch of people that are part of it. Not every Independent Media is part of the IMA, but it's a good starting point if you're interested and you might find something local about it. There's always stuff happening. Check out Declassified UK. Check out Hamza's work. Absolutely fucking brilliant. I'll stop swearing now. But yeah, you can find us at News Club UK. And I don't think you're on Instagram, actually, are you? Are you? You're
on. Yes. Go on, give us your handles, Hamza.
In my head, you're on X.
Tell the world.
Yeah, go on.
They're quite similar, actually. I think Twitter's Hamza_A96. And I believe Instagram, and I'm definitely not looking at my phone to find it, is Hamza.A96_.
Amazing. Well, yeah, go follow, go look at those viral reels where he says something really cool. And everyone's like,
go and flame him for support of Liverpool after beating Bournemouth on Friday.
I've had to tone down some of the tweets. Tom will know this, I used to tweet mid-game about 100 times, effing and blinding, and just wasn't a good look.
I think it paired really well with like your you know what? Righteous, justified, you know, analysis and commentary on Palestine mixed in with, why didn't he pass the ball? Salah's washed.
Absolutely brilliant. Okay, well, that's amazing. Thank you, guys. Thank you for your time. And we'll catch you, check out previous episodes and come along to the Online News Club.
Bye.
Goodbye, all.
Take care.